Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage Podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum. Here on the Aerospace Advantage Podcast, we speak with leaders in the DoD, industry, academia, and other subject matter experts to explore the intersection between strategy, operational concepts, technology, and policy when it comes to air and space power. So if you like learning about aerospace power, you are in the right place. As we wrap up season one of the Aerospace Advantage Podcast, we're taking the opportunity to let you, our listeners, learn a bit more about the folks that make up the Mitchell Institute team. If you're new to the podcast, this is a great place to start and get to know the regular contributors to the podcast and other various projects that occur at the Mitchell Institute. Now, Aerospace Nation is our video series that you can find on YouTube with key leaders around the Air and Space Forces. And the flagship product from the Mitchell Institute are our various written reports, papers, and other thought pieces that investigate and recommend vectors to our elected officials, their staff, industry, and of course, the women and men in uniform. So with that, we're bringing in the team to discuss a few flying stories to have a little fun as we reflect on our operational days. Well, General Deptula, I know we always have an opportunity to stand around the water cooler, which is the best part for me about being at Mitchell. But I'd absolutely love to hear one of the stories that that you'd love to share with the audience here.
Well, thanks, Slick. In thinking about this, it's pretty tough. You know, I flew the Eagle for 33 and a half years, so I've got a lot of stories.
And sir, you're the highest ranking guy ever to fly the Eagle, is that right?
Well, not the highest ranking guy. I mean, there are a bunch of four stars that have flown the Eagle. But I am the only Air Force officer who was fully combat mission qualified in the F-15 at every rank from lieutenant to lieutenant general.
Well, that's definitely pretty amazing.
As you know, FMC in a jet, generally folks drop off of that at about the colonel rank. And so I had the great privilege of being combat mission qualified as a one-star, two-star, and three-star. And so one of the stories I'm going to tell is when I was a Northern Watch commander, Combined Task Force Operation Northern Watch in Northern Iraq. And so I guess I'll kick off with that one. I was very, when I got that assignment, my predecessors flew, but they flew training sorties. They didn't fly inside Iraq on the combat missions. And I went, hell, that ain't my style of leadership. If I'm going to lead, I'm leading while I'm in combat. So I got checked out, you know, recalled in a jet, checked out as a flight lead, and led lots of missions. And on this one particular day, we're flying around Northern Iraq, and I'm looking down, and I see this muzzle flash, pretty high caliber gun. I didn't know it was a 100-millimeter gun at the time, but that's what it ended up being. And I saw this muzzle flash, and then, you know, there's the shell explosion. I estimated maybe 1,000 feet below me, but I'm thinking, huh, now that's interesting. And when I was thinking back on this story, I'm going, okay, where's the guy I was flying with? And he must have been a ground aboard or something, but I was kind of up there by myself. And so I fly past, and then I come back the opposite direction in the same location. And another muzzle flash. So I go, okay, well, this is interesting. So I lean down on my data card that I've got, strapped to my leg and a lineup card, and I start drawing a picture of the environment because this was, it was really, the gun flash came out of an orchard, and there were like four or five orchards, and they all were like fingers. They were we called them the finger orchards, and they were pointing toward Mosul. And I started drawing this on my card to indicate where the muzzle flashes were coming from because my thought at the time was, hey, I'll hand this off to the recce guys. They're Royal Air Force Jaguars at the time. They can go out, take pictures. We can find this place and blow it up. And then about, 20 milliseconds later, I go, well, why would I do that? Why don't I just call AWACS, get the F-15Es who are carrying bombs and F-16s over here, and we'll just blow the crap out of them right now. And so I did that. I went up on it to AWACS. I said, hey, guys. And I said, hey, where are the E-models? Get them over here. And they said, well, they're doing a response action over at Lake Saddam. Now, what we had done in the rules of engagement I'd worked out with the Turks, which were our hosts out of Incirlik, was that we could respond to any element of the Iraqi integrated air defense system if we witnessed a hostile act against us. So it didn't have to be a response to the perpetrating missile or AAA site. And so before every mission, we designated sites that we wanted to respond to. And the E-models were actually dropping on a couple of sites in response to my calling out the AAA shooting at me. Make a long story short, actually make it a little longer. I get a hold of a couple of F-16 CJs that I knew were up there, because obviously the cool thing about Northern Watch is I would give the overarching mission brief, or words, not necessarily the mission brief, to every mission that we flew, because we had all of the elements located there at Interlake. So I knew the CJ guys were up there, and I knew that they were carrying CBU 87, a combined effects munition, which was a perfect munition for this site because it was kind of hidden by foliage, and so you couldn't see exactly where it was. You needed sort of an area munition. So by and by, I got them up. I sent them over to where my locale was and said, okay, you guys, watch this. And so I fly back over the exact same path to draw the enemy fire, and sure enough, like clockwork, they fired at me again. I wasn't too worried about getting hit because the last time a thing exploded about 1,000 feet below me or so, I'm just estimating. And sure enough, so I go, okay, guys, you got a tally on it? Yep, you got it. All right, you're cleared in hot. And so turns out the guy was a first lieutenant on his first Northern Watch mission, and the first time he dropped CBU 87. And he dropped, and so I said, I'm watching this whole thing, you know, I'm bird dogging the fight. And I said, hey, listen, let's just imagine that, I mean, where you hit was, you know, about 300 yards north. Imagine that you have five fingers pointing toward Mosul. You really want to come up to about the middle knuckle on where that is. And so I'm an air-to-air F-15 C model guy doing, I think, what might be the first airborne forward air controller mission in the Eagle from wherever altitude I was flying out, which is in the upper 30s probably. And he goes, okay, got it. And so, and maybe he flew off. We got a couple of E models come in, drop some, drop some GBU 12s on this site. And so I'm talking folks back and forth on. And then I finally get the F-16 guy, C model, back on. He was CJ because his number one was, he was carrying HARMS and he was carrying CBU. And I said, Shaq, that's pretty good. And, we got the rest of them to roll in on the immediate vicinity. And I said, you know, one more canister of CBU ought to do it. And Lead said, hey, listen, we're out of CBU, but we still have plenty of 20 millimeter left. And I remember, because I took notes, and I went back and I was referring to this a couple weeks ago, and my response was, okay, let's not get greedy. When in fact, the concern was, you know, it was really risk assessment. You don't need to be dropping down low and strafing these dudes with 20 mic when we got plenty of bombs. And so what happens in the end game is that we had some of the first EP-3s from the Navy flying reconnaissance support for us. And through a variety of different intelligence means, what we found out was we had killed 4 out of 5 100-millimeter AAA pieces on that mission. So I was pretty happy that night, and recall buying the Northern Watch Armada, the bar, that night, and it was a quite successful mission. And again, kind of unusual when you've got an F-15C guy, not to mention the Combined Task Force commander, orchestrating a hit on a couple of sites that are shooting at them. But it worked out very, very well.
Sounds like it. It's absolutely incredible, sir. Really appreciate you sharing the story.
Okay, I got one more shorter one. So one of the first of many stories after having flown the jet for many, many, many years actually occurred, and it was a significant, not only was it a significant emotional event, it was a significant career event, because after this event, it actually drove a series of actions that changed the path of my career. It happened on my second solo flight in the F-15 on the 29th of June, 1977. And you might say, holy smokes, he remembered the date. He must have looked it up. No. After I tell you what happened, you'll understand why it was a significant emotional event. So I'm going through the world-famous and highly respected triple nickel.
Absolutely.
Which at the time, yeah, you're saying that because you're an F-16 guy. I'm saying it because it was the first F-15A FTU, RTU. And so a guy by the name of Moody Suter, who some in the audience might recognize, was the squadron commander, Lieutenant Colonel Moody Suter. And the ops officer was Major, he might have been Lieutenant Colonel T.C. Skanky, which was he was a pretty famous F-4 pilot as well. And so I'm on my second solo flight. It's probably 120 degrees outside. We do a formation takeoff. Obviously, I'm the number two guy. And right after takeoff, we're taking off on runway 21. And it's the Flatiron Gladden 5 departure. I remember the departure, too. Takeoff in afterburner, come back to below mill because there's an intermediate level off as you go straight. And then you do a 90-degree turn, push it up to mill, and start a climb and follow the rest of the departure procedure. And so, you know, I do the takeoff. I'm flying on the wing. We do the right turn. And then as we go to accelerate to mill, I hear this enormous explosion. The airplane starts shaking like you're in a, I don't know, it's hard to describe what it was shaking like, but it was shaking like hell. And I immediately get a solid firelight on the left engine. I glance over to the engines. The left RPM gauge is pegged to zero. About this time, my flight lead says, hey, two, you're on fire. You got smoke coming out your left engine. And so, you know, throttle idle, fire warning light push, throttle off, fire extinguisher discharge. I'll always remember the emergency procedure for that because I did it. And then the second reason I'll remember it is because the next thought that went through my mind was, you know, when I do this in the simulator, the firelight goes out, but the firelight's still on. So I went through the procedure again to make sure that I'd done everything. And actually, the first time I did it so fast, I didn't completely depress the firelight. But it shouldn't have mattered because when you shut the throttle off, that cuts off the fuel at the engine. The firelight shuts it off at the accelerator-mounted accessory drive. I can even remember AMAD, what it stood for. Anyway, so this is happening. So I make an immediate right-hand turn and kind of go into a rectangular pattern to come back to the airfield. And the White Tank Mountains are just to the right of Luke, and that's a designated bailout area. I'm not thinking bailout at this time because, you know, I'm flying the airplane's sort of under control, or at least enough. Someone said, hey, you better dump some gas. So, I started dumping gas because I'm fully loaded right after takeoff with, I think the A models carried at 13,000 internal. No, it was 11,400. Okay. There's another one I remember from 40 whatever years ago. So I'm coming around, I'm doing this pattern, firelight's still on. I ask Rhett Butler, that was the name of the pilot. And, you know, he said, hey, you're still trailing smoke. And I go, yeah, whatever, it's flying well, I'm going to land this thing. So I line up on runway 21 left at Luke. And those who fly out there, Sun City's right under the approach end of Luke. And someone reminded me, hey, you might stop dumping gas now. So I did. And I'm about a mile out on final. I see the runway in front of me, and now I get an overheat warning on the right engine. So I have a solid firelight on the left, and now I got a flashing overheat on the right. And, you know, those pilots out there kind of are thinking, well, that's not real hot. So I look over at the White Tank Mountains and think, this is maybe a bailout kind of thing. And then I look at the runway in front of me. And one of my instructors, Lars Granath, old F-4 guy, and I can remember him talking about, hey, you know, you get a fire engine. What you do is the bleed air circuit, you select the opposite source. And I guess that worked in F-4s. I did it anyway. The light kind of flickered. It never went out when I went, and I kind of went to myself, screw it, I'm landing this thing. And so I land, I roll out. And I still had the firelight. I can't remember where the overheat light flickered and went out or not. And so I'm rolling down the runway and get to a stop. And, of course, the fire truck is coming up behind me. And this is when we still had foam. So this is kind of where the interesting part comes. I mean, lots of people have had engine fires. All right, they deal with them, no big deal. So the interesting part is, so I'm flying the, by the way, this F-15 was painted air superiority blue, and we still had the IC-7 seats. It's before we had ACES 2 seats. So what everyone would always forget was the safing device in the IC-7 was behind your helmet. It was called a head knocker. And I was so proud of myself because in my emergency escape, you know, procedures, I remember to safe the seat. I took all my stuff off. Obviously, there's not a ladder there, but there's an internal ladder in the F-15. You put your foot in the side, you hit this button, and a ladder comes down. So I lift the canopy, I'm climbing over the side, and all of a sudden, I just get completely hosed down with foam. Because what's happened is the fire truck has missed the engine, shot over the wings, and covered me and the cockpit in foam. Now, not intentionally, you know, they're just trying to hose down the jet. Well, if you know anything about foam, it's designed to suck the oxygen out of the atmosphere. So now I can not only not see, I can't breathe. So I'm rapidly trying to feel for, because of emergency procedures, they hang on the canopy bow on the jet and then kind of drop down. The top of the F-15 canopy, or the canopy rail, is about 12 feet above the ground. So it's not just a hop, skip, and a jump. And I grab the rail, and when I release my weight, you know, this stuff, this foam is slicker than owl. I mean, so I just slip right off the airplane. As I'm falling backwards, I reach out to break my fall, and what I broke instead was my wrist. So the next thing I remember is the wing commander comes up to me and goes, "What happened? What happened?" Because this is early in the F-15. I think this was the first or the second major fire. And I'm thinking to myself, "Hey, Colonel, I'll let you know after I get someone to look at my wrist, but it's really hurting right now." Anyway, that's another part of the story. Long story short, here's what had happened. When I went to mill power, this is before they had an electronic engine control. They only had a mechanical engine control to limit the speed of the turbine. Well, that broke down. Turbine basically accelerated uncontrollably and threw turbine blades everywhere, and that it essentially the engine disintegrated. And so if you looked at the airplane empennage afterwards, someone took a hole punch and put holes all around the engine or all around the airframe. And one of the holes was the bulkhead between the engines. So there was a big 9-12 inch hole between the engines. And the reason I got the overheat light isn't because the red engine was overheated. It was because there was still residual fuel and oil on fire on the left engine bay. And as I slowed down to approach speed, that heat set off the engine detection circuitry on the right side. So it's a good thing I didn't jump out. This was a big deal because when you have engine fires in F4s, people were going, "Oh man, that was awesome." You know, I'm going, "Hey, I'm just trying to recover the jet." The engine stopped so quickly that it bent the empennage. Normally, it takes 15, 20 minutes to pull an engine out of a C model. It took them 9 hours. And essentially what they ended up doing was sending the jet back to St. Louis. McDonnell Douglas cut off the empennage, put on another one, and then they gave the jet to Israel. So as far as I know, it's still flying in Israel. It's tail number 74114. Okay, so what happens to me? Well, I'm going through the triple nickel, and I'd broken the bone in my wrist, and 3 weeks later, it healed. That was kind of unheard of. As a matter of fact, some dude wrote an article about it in the Harvard Medical Journal, because normally that bone doesn't heal. Well, it healed enough that I could get back on flight status. It was about 3 to 4 weeks after this happened. And the class that started after mine in the 461st was about the same spot I was in the training syllabus when this happened to me. So they switched me out of the triple nickel over to the 461st. Now, here's the other part of the story. The reason that affected my career is everyone in the nickel went to Langley. And then everyone in the 461st, we went on to top off at the 550th. And then when we all went to Holloman, and then later all went to Kadena and And so it started a career progression very much different than if I'd stayed in the triple nickel. Now, here's the other part. And I'm unveiling this in public for the first time. But some people know the story. So there were seven other students in the 461st. And the IPs had named them all after the seven dwarfs. So I'm the eighth dude. So guess what I get to be? Snow White. And as you can imagine, it was not the most desirable call sign. But the call sign stories, I mean, if you were dopey or snoozy, you weren't happy with that either. So as we all got on to our next assignment, the squadron commander allowed name changes. But I'll knock it off there. It was quite the event.
Well, that's awesome, sir. Thanks so much for sharing that. I appreciate it.
So, you know, I kind of thought about some of the stories that I'd share, and there's two from Iraqi Freedom in 2003, because I was in the DC Guard, and we flew Block 30 Vipers. We were C+, which we thought was really cool, because as Block 30s, the pre-blocks, the Guard owned the OFP, so we could modernize them, put on different widgets and sensors and so forth that was not the same as the active duty. And this was important because, you know, the sniper program was behind. We weren't on track to get Link 16 anytime soon. And so the Guard had accelerated an alternate modernization path of getting the Lightning targeting pod, putting on saddle and so forth. So I'm a baby lieutenant, actually now I was a baby captain at the time when we're getting ready to go over to OIF, still a wingman. And we're going to head over there. We were specifically chosen to do the counter-scud mission because we had the saddle. And with the saddle, we could actually talk free text with the Army. And that was one of the things that was important about that data link, was that we could then communicate with the Army, we could communicate with soft troops on the ground in Western Iraq looking for these scuds. And we had this gateway that allowed us then to plug into Link 16 as well. And we mounted this data link gateway on the back of a Humvee, and that sucker drove around the Western deserts of Iraq. We called it the buggy for the battlefield upgraded gateway expeditionary unit. So anyhow, everyone loves their acronyms. But I was primarily a nighttime fighter because I'd primarily flown combat air patrols in Enduring Freedom at night, the midnight to 4 a.m. shift. Woohoo! And so I had all this nighttime and all the MVGs, and so I was pretty comfortable on them. And so I flew mostly at night, and we were looking for scuds and, you know, underneath overpasses and all the different hiding spots that we knew of in Western Iraq. And depending on how you want to count it, we were either a miserable failure because we never found any scuds and no scuds were launched, or we were totally successful because they never brought the scuds out and they never launched them. So it's kind of like that 0-0. Either you're a total loser or you are, like, you know, total victor. But the other thing that we did, because we were working with special ops troops over there, was supporting them when they came in contact with enemy forces over in the Western deserts. And so Haditha Dam had really lit off because, you know, the Iraqis had been told that we were going to try and blow up the dam to flood the farmland to the south and really, you know, wreak havoc. And so they were trying to take the dam. We were trying to keep the dam because we had been told that they were going to blow it up and blame it on us. So there was a group of special ops guys, maybe like, you know, less than 100 or something. It was a really small number, and they were under serious attack by the Iraqis, heavily, heavily outnumbered. So we get called in off of our lines of, we had these areas that we would scour, and we had specific hide sites we'd have to go look for, and we'd troll up and down those. So we get called over to Haditha Dam, and it was chaotic. What was going on there. And, it's nighttime, but it was still very difficult to be able to find where the incoming fires were coming from, because the soft guys, they had their noggins down. They could not reveal themselves, and so it was very difficult for them to try to send us points of origin. And so we're out there looking around, and, you know, we're trying to search in our targeting pods, which were so much better than the lantern pods. Man, looking at a lantern pod was kind of like looking like a 1970s sonogram, you know? I mean, like, it was just like a blob. You couldn't really tell what the hell it was.
Yes, Heather, just to put it in context, we all thought that lantern pods were like manna from heaven during Desert Storm. And if you recall, they were brand new then. I mean, very few, the E models had, the F-111Es. and a handful of F-15Es had them back then. But that's it's funny to hear, but it's a good comparison.
Yeah, you know, it's how many times did we target tactical bushes with a lantern pod, and you look at it on a lightning pod, and you'd be like, oh, no, that's definitely not tactical. But and so we're looking in the drool cup, you know, we're just sniveling inside the targeting pod, trying to see what we can pick out. You know, EO, you know, wasn't really useful going, white hot Black Hawk and switching between our different methodologies. And you're looking through a soda straw, and we couldn't see anything. And I look outside my MBGs, and I just happen to catch a mortar getting fired off. And I can't see the pit, but I can see the heat of the mortar going through the air. So I'm able to see the heat from this mortar round. It's almost like a tracer. So I'm able to sort of reverse the vector of the tracer down to the point of origin. And I got my eyeballs, you know, through my MVGs locked on to that point of origin. And I'm able to take my lightning pod and put it into laser marker mode, squeeze off, the laser marker, which is like a dot, 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 and track that sucker over to where I've got my targeting pod now, where that point of origin is. And I'm still just the wingman, but I've seen this. I've got my targeting pod set on where the mortar pit is. And so my flight lead rolls in, and he says, all right, dial this in, this code in to your targeting pod, and he just drops. And he's able to drop because when I come on the radio and I say, I've got it, I can see the pit, immediately the soft guys come on and they say, you are cleared hot, danger close, and they give us their initials right away. And in the background, I can hear guys yelling, I can hear stuff blowing up. I mean, it was absolutely crazy. And then the bomb hits and things got real quiet. And we transferred over to the next two ship coming in and went and took some gas and headed off to our next trolling for Scuds.
Very cool.
But here's another funny story from Iraq as well. And this was kind of unusual because I was on the day crew that day. So my circadian rhythm's all messed up and we're flying around. And again, we're just doing the boring work of looking for Scuds and not finding anything. And we get called in by some soft guys. And they've been trekking across the desert, again, doing their JOBs. And they come across this convoy of Iraqi tanks. And the tanks aren't moving. And they're like, man, they don't know what's going on. They can't figure out why the tanks are not moving. They're thinking maybe they've been located by the Iraqi army. But, you know, they've got some distance. They're staying down undercover. They can't really figure out what's going on, so they're super worried. They call us in. And, again, we're looking through the drool cups of the targeting pods trying to figure this out. And we're looking through it as well. And we can't figure out what's going on with this convoy.
Are they hot?
It was, yeah, I mean, the tanks were hot, and we couldn't figure out what was going on, and that we couldn't really identify them.
So they weren't just parked there storage.
No, I mean, they were lined up. I mean, it was very clearly like they were lined up going somewhere, and we're getting lower and lower, and we're trying to look more and more, and they're really hard to ID, and we're thinking, you know, this has just got to be an issue with the targeting pods. We're playing with our focus and, you know, going wide and narrow. And finally, I look out the window, and we are on a targeting range. The reason why the tanks weren't moving is because they were targets. There was a big old bullseye with a nuke run-in line, and and I look a little bit further, and there's a couple, you know, real beat up MiGs, and so yep, we were on an Iraqi Air Force targeting range.
Well, that's good you didn't expend any munitions, or did you?
No,
is
we
that
didn't.
The rest of the story?
No, we didn't, but that sure as heck would have been fun.
Yeah. Okay. Cool.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to kind of bridge the gap because we had some similar type of experiences. And I had the good fortune of getting, being a young guy when I went to Iraq and Afghanistan, splitting ops out of Qatar. And I did get to fly in both theaters quite a bit. And I was primarily a night guy. I was a two-ship flight lead for the day. And when we first got over in country, quickly got my night two-ship flight lead upgrade done in wartime, so that was pretty cool, having a grade sheet, like, you know, over OIF, you're now a two-ship flight lead full up. And kind of like Heather described, you know, we're flying around at night, MVGs, lantern pods. We had half the jets with lightning and half the jets with lantern pods, and it's kind of like Spaceballs, you know. It's like, did you guys see anything? Like, we didn't see, you know what, you know, we didn't see So after about halfway through the deployment, they go, all right, Slick, you get to switch over to days now. And pretty cool. And the culture that I grew up in as a triple nickel dude was, you know, we're at Alviano, and Bosnia and Kosovo are still peacekeeping operations. So guys are flying combat missions every day. And, you know, the stories and the history was like, you know, in Bosnia and Kosovo, of guys like Tater Uribe, over 1,000 hours in combat. At the time, Captain Gustella, who was off to the weapons school and think came back and was the patch there. And, you know, these guys would tell stories about, you know, what it was like to do close air support, get shot at, and they'd get a place to where they'd, you know, wheel it up like they were doing the bombing range, like Heather just described, right? You got a big bullseye on the ground, and you'd go out and practice and in a kind of a permissive environment once you would get it there, because you'd destroy the enemy to a level where you felt like you could move around. So I get switched over to days, and now I'm flying with Lieutenant Colonel Guastella, who is a squadron commander, and kind of gives me the day checkout since I hadn't been flying in the day yet. And then I go out the next day, and now I'm leading a two ship, and the weather is absolutely horrible. I mean, it is a solid deck from 2,000 AGL to like 15,000 feet. Our guys are totally engaged in Fallujah. Referencing the time frame, it's, you know, American Sniper is literally happening underneath us. So we've got two ship expending every munition they can, trying to go after, you know, multiple rooftop snipers that have taken position across the city and are taking Marines out left and right. So there was this one area that had two snipers on the rooftop, and the two ship before us did everything they could trying to neutralize this target. Guy was still firing heavy. They couldn't give us a good, you know, fighter to fighter handoff because they were like both below bingo and it was time for them to go home. So we get down through the weather, which is, you know, kind of dumb move number one, because, you know, you just think, well, I hope I don't hit anything because I can't really see anything. You get a pseudo radar letdown through the weather, but we don't really know the terrain. We don't know what towers are out there and that type of thing. But we get down below the weather, and
so dude, how low were you? Like, were you below 2,000?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, we're raging around at like 500 feet.
Wow.
So it's 2,000 feet AGL. This is, you know, another dumb thing, because now we're like the proverbial bugs on a bedsheet, right? A dark gray fighter against a light white background in the middle of the afternoon. But it was only like 3 miles of visibility, which is kind of good for us, but really, really bad, because as you just described, Heather, I had that same lantern pod. And when you're going 425 knots with 3 miles of vis and 2,000 feet AGL, really hard to stay tally of the target and visual friendlies and try to use any sort of precision munition, which is what they wanted, obviously, because they were way within troops and contact. So friendlies and enemy forces are within a kilometer of each other. And I call over my wingman. I'm like, all right, man, you know, let's go shoot or cover. They're looking for weapons. And then the Marines were all over it. They had their Humvees. They had their marker panels out. They're marking the target with white phosphorus mortars, which was really, really cool just to see these things hitting the target. It's like, you know, white popcorn flashing off all over the place. So they get us talked into the target, and finally the ground commander gives us initials, but he wanted, you know, 500-pound laser guided bombs. And even in wide field of view, so zoomed out as far as I could, getting as far away from the target as I couldn't maintain, you know, the fact that I knew that that was exactly the target. So I offered him, like, hey, the ballistics are the same. I can, you know, drop this thing and just in CCIP, so computer impact point. And they're like, nope, if it's not laser guided, we don't want it. I'm like, all right, well, I have the gun. And kind of like General Deptula mentioned before, we don't want to get greedy, and we don't need to be taking the risk of getting down and in and amongst them. And I also knew, and it's kind of like the Dos Gringos song, the last guy that strafed in Iraq got sent home, and it wasn't a good party. But when you hear Americans screaming on the ground, asking for help, you go, all right, it's time to do it. So like the stories of old in my fighter squadron, I'm like, all right, man, to my wingman, he's now Colonel Spider Walker, wheel it up, here we go. And like, I'm gonna give you 20 millimeter strafe pass. They're like, okay, great, because the collateral damage was a lot smaller, reduced the risk to the friendlies. So I roll in on my initial pass, and there were like three guys running with
extra bullets and, you know, munition cache stuff. And so I was able to take those guys out running to the three-story building there, come off, and my wingman goes blind. We were supposed to do a shooter attack. Yeah, so unfortunately he goes blind, and I just send him to the tanker. And that shooter attack didn't happen. I come back around, was able to take a second strafe pass and empty the gun on the rooftop and take out the two snipers. And I tell you that feeling, you know, I light the AB because I'm way down low and I know I'm going to go, you know, zoom to the clouds, staying away from any potential threat coming at me after I'm hitting the same target in the same direction twice, knowing that it was really easy for the guys on the ground to track. But yeah, it was just one of those like, holy cow. And I just remember getting through the clouds and my hands were just shaking and you're just thinking like, oh my God, I just did it. I just did the thing that we all train for. And of course, you know, knowing that you're helping guys on the ground and when they tell you, you know, direct hit, you got the target, it makes it all worth it.
Very cool.
So I got one last stupid lieutenant story. I'm going through the B course and I'm down at Kelly, and we're just getting into to BFM, so basic fighter maneuvers. We're gonna learn how to really enter the turn circle and get some lead, and that's all good. Well, they're block 30s, and they're not just block 30s, big mouth block 30s.
So did you have an iron sight? Was that the best you have? I'm sorry. I think they probably improved that with the block 15s.
Well, you know, the issue wasn't necessarily how good the sight was. I think the issue was all with, you know, how good I was, which was not. You know, I'm a brand new lieutenant, just starting to learn how to do turn circle entries. It's a standard 6K, you know. I got the squadron commander, Elvis Presley, in my back seat. And we're starting this up at about 19,000 feet, and floor is 10,000. And I zoom past the turn circle, but I'm like, I got this. I mean, it's an F-16, right? You're just going to hork back on the stick a little bit more. And I do, and I hork back on the stick, and I keep on, you know, I keep the pull coming, and I keep the airplane at AB, and I am stuck in lag. And there we go, marching from 19,000 feet all the way down to 10,500 feet at 9 Gs in full afterburner. After about, oh gosh, I don't know. Once we do one or two 360s down there at 10,000, Elvis goes, knock it off, knock it. He goes, at the time my call sign was Peso for Peso Penny. He goes, Peso, are you trying to kill me?
Yeah.
I did get better at my turn circle entries.
I'm going to be nice, Heather, because, you know, I want to keep you working for me, but so I won't elaborate on F-15, F-16, BFM stories, but, you know, I'm glad they upgraded you from an iron sight. Slick, on the other hand.
Thank you, our listeners, for your continued support, and thank you for tuning in to today's show. We've got a lot of new and exciting content coming your way, including a few lighthearted flying stories for the holidays, and then some deep dives on space capabilities to kick off the new year. We will also be heading out to air and space events near you, so don't forget to follow or subscribe to the podcast. Also, follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn to find out where we will be next year, and also to learn about what the Mitchell team has in our sight picture. And please, don't forget to leave us a rating. Hit the like button and follow or subscribe to the Airspace Advantage. You can also leave us a comment to let us know what you think about the show or areas you think we should explore further. And visit us at MitchellAerospacePower.org to get the latest reports, events, and analysis that are charting vectors for our air and space forces. Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you next time. Stay safe and check six.